Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. On today's show, we'll be paying special tribute to the legendary feminist poet and thinker, Audrianne Rich, who died on March 27, 2012, at the age of 82. I had the great pleasure as a freelance journalist of interviewing Rich in November of 1995 in San Francisco when she was on tour with her book, Dark Fields of the Republic. We will air that interview and also talk to poet and editor and Ithaca College professor of writing and women's studies, Catherine Howe Mahan, who published a memorial collection for Rich last year called Audrianne Rich, a Tribute Anthology. It was published by Split Oak Press and features dozens of accomplished poets who are influenced and inspired by Rich's fire and brilliance. And welcome to the show, Catherine.
Thank you, Tish.
You put together this great anthology, but I want you to talk to me a little bit about how Audrianne Rich influenced your life as a poet and as a woman.
It was in the mid-70s when my good friend Beverly Tannenhaus, a real visionary, created the Women's Writing Workshops, the first in the country summer program to bring women together. And she had Audrianne as her very first keynote at it. So it was soon after that time that I first heard Audrianne read. She has been a thread through my life as a feminist, as a poet, certainly as a teacher, especially helping young women to find their voices and dare to bring those voices out into the world.
Yeah, yeah. She had such a power, and she's such a little tiny woman, as all of us who have met her realize, and I was shocked by. Yeah. Tell us what the response was when you put out the word about this anthology from other women poets.
Even before it had reached Poets and Writers magazine, with the ad reaching people, Ellen Bass and Barbara Crooker got it out on listservs, and work started coming in immediately, I would say within 3 days. Certainly within a week of my even conceiving of the idea, work started pouring in.
Wow, and that's amazing to me. What was the key to this idea of doing this anthology?
And, I got the news that Audrianne had died, and of course Marge Piercy wrote a poem immediately, and it was published by Ms. the day after, I'm thinking, what can I do? I've got to do something. It's not just enough to mourn her quietly. And then I said, this is it. There must be others like me who have written because of her, who have written about her. Let me see what can happen. I spoke to my colleague, Jim Stafford. He went for the idea immediately. Poets and Writers liked the idea so much, they even gave us half price on the ad.
Wow.
We got it in at the last minute for the May issue. I just knew I had to create a written tribute of as many voices as I could about Audrianne's life.
Did you talk to her longtime partner, Michelle Cliff, about this at all?
No, I acted immediately because it's not that I was close to her. I was not in any kind of an inner circle, not in touch with her directly at all.
Mm-hmm.
No, like many, such a long-range effect that she's had on so many lives.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what was the criterion for accepting poems? Did they have to be about her or just women affected
by her?
They were
either, this is what I'm so glad that I made this anthology different from many, in that as the letters started coming in with the poems, I'm realizing these comments that people are making could be as important as the poems themselves. So in the contributors' notes, besides the bios, I have notes from each person, why they wrote the poem. How did they come to write this particular poem?
That's amazing.
Some it was because they'd heard her read. Some had never met her at all, but her published works had affected them so profoundly. So the stories that are in the contributors' bios are amazing.
Yeah, yeah, and this is an amazing anthology. It's gorgeous, gorgeous poetry in it. Really heartfelt and amazing to me. I read most of it over the last few weeks.
It was a deep, deep delight for me to dedicate such a big piece of my summer last year to get that book, and that Jim worked with me so tightly with excellent Ithaca College student interns with my department, the writing department, and we got that book out so that when the celebration for it happened, we had the copies on September 8th, and Marge Piercy came in with her husband Ira Wood and others performing, and it was a huge celebration of Audrianne's life.
Yeah, yeah. So many women I know feel that she was creating a world and a landscape, forging a kind of a path for women who would come after her. Do you think she was consciously trying to do that, or was she just doing
her thing?
She,
I believe, is who she had to be.
Yeah.
And I always refer to her when I say to people, okay, what's the definition of feminism, right? Okay, a feminist is someone who looks at the world and says it needs to change. A feminist activist is someone who starts doing something about it. A radical feminist activist like Adrienne Rich cuts the swath, goes further than many people dare, so the ones behind her can just go that little bit further.
Yeah. Yeah, she's amazing. And Of Woman Born is still affecting people.
Absolutely.
For her great essay. Yeah, that was an amazing book to so many of us.
Absolutely.
I want to have you read your poem in this anthology. It's called Swimming with Fish. Can you read it for us?
I'd be happy to.
And tell us a little bit about it.
Mm-hmm. Because of her winning major award, Diving into the Wreck is probably the single most famous poem of hers. So working with that metaphor, this is about her. Swimming with Fish, for Adrienne Rich. Deep and deeper now, she undulates into cool silence, redefining green and blue with silver, shadows, sand. On the way to sunken treasure, mesh bag in her moving fist, she becomes a new bright creature, almost naked. Her braided hair, two long, thin, golden wings. They come now, the turquoise ones. Eyes like jewels she's searching for. Fins of rippling amethyst. Hundreds of them helping her. Guides again to the black ship, where she will find new breath and rise. Coins and emeralds in her grasp. To share. To give to all the women who cannot dive as she does, risk her life, her body's pulse, her eyes.
That's wonderful. Now, I'd like to play the interview that I did with her. It was in November of 1995. I was working as a freelance journalist and had the great honor of getting a chance to interview Adrienne while she was on tour with her book, Dark Fields of the Republic. I met her at the Marriott Hotel in San Francisco, and I'm thrilled to be able to share this interview with you now. I'm pleased to welcome Adrienne Rich to Hibernia Beach.
I'm happy to be here.
You know, reading through the book, I really sense a great sorrow on those pages. I feel you have a lot of sorrow about the unfolding of events, both politically and socially, in your lifetime up to this point. Is that true?
Well, I hope that this is a book of... because I feel it came out of a very necessary grappling with the reality of where we have arrived in this country overall at the end of the century, and some very grim and harsh realities. But I think of it also very much as a book of life, a book that sprang from the love of life and love for the world and love for human society and anger at its perversion, and I'm using that very loaded word in a very specific way, because I feel that we are beholding the perversion of human bonds, the perversion of human love, to an extraordinary degree on the part of the right, on the part of most of the media.
You talk about the media and being lied to, knowing what it means to be lied to. I found that incredibly poignant. Do you feel like you're constantly being lied to?
Well, I think we who monitor the politicians and their activities, we who are subjected to what's on television, what Hollywood is producing, we're constantly being lied to. We're constantly being provided not only with phony versions of history and phony versions of reality, but very degrading images of all of our lives. And, you know, I think as lesbians or as gay men, we can see the ways in which our lives are willfully perverted by the media.
Exactly.
But the media, that same media is perverting the lives of everyone.
Seems to be. It takes it down to the lowest common denominator. No one sees themselves in media portrayals.
And yet I don't want to, you know, I don't want to just sort of isolate the media and point the finger at that, because it is only the tool of much larger and more expansive corporate interests, mm-hmm. global interests. I mean, what I think we're looking at this point, and I say this not so much with sorrow but with horror, we're looking at what some might call a late stage of capitalism. We're looking at capitalism devoid of any effort at or pretense of a human face.
Do you think we're headed for our doom?
No, I don't think the book remotely suggests that.
No,
and
I don't
intend remotely to suggest that. But I think that particularly for liberals, it's been possible for many, many decades in this country to sort of bemoan certain things but not really look at the whole structure within which we live. I think we're reaching a point where that's no longer possible, where it's no longer possible to be a liberal. You know, you have to mm-hmm. become a radical or
yeah.
You'll be swallowed up by it all, and not necessarily because you choose to be or want to be, but because you haven't defined yourself against it.
You know, that brings me to your poem, Revolution in Permanence. I found that particularly moving. I've always been obsessed with the thought of Ethel Rosenberg. Do you use her as a symbol of a woman who's been silenced? Is that what was in your mind with that?
Not just that. I mean, she's been an important figure in my life. She was, she and her husband were electrocuted in 1953. I was 24 years old.
They were electrocuted 3 days before I was born.
And the week before I was married.
Really?
Yes.
Odd.
That image in the press, in the headlines, everywhere, was very horrifying, very powerful, and at the same time inexplicable to me at the in the state of political consciousness that I was in at that time. And it's been many years of trying to struggle with the figure of Ethel Rosenberg in particular, but the Rosenberg case, in any event, it's been a long road for me. But, you know, it was the height of the McCarthy period, and I was living through that. But then again, as a very young person, very naive and innocent in certain ways, who was coming into maturity in a climate of such virulent anti-communism, such fear around even the word itself.
Do you think we're in a climate where that could happen again?
Well, I think I think that the whole question now of who is behind bars in the criminal justice system, you know, is one of the big questions we have to look at in this society. But we have, for instance, someone like Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is on death row, who is still appealing for a retrial, and I really don't know which way that will go, but it's a very important case. It's a case that has been totally or almost totally occluded by the O.J. Simpson case.
Oh, yes. That took over the country's consciousness for so long.
And so, you know, the whole question of what we're hearing and seeing and what are we not hearing and seeing is an equally important question.
You always refer to yourself as an outsider in a lot of your essays. Do you still feel that way, an outsider as a lesbian, as a woman?
Well, what I think I've been trying to talk about is that there is a potential outsider's vision, which we, some of us, I'm white, I'm middle class. I'm a woman, a lesbian, a Jew. But there's a potential for the eye of the outsider, which is a tremendously important potential because it allows us to be and to act in solidarity with other and different outsiders. And this is, I guess, what I feel as a lesbian, particularly what I feel with regard to the gay and lesbian community in particular, that I constantly want to see that outsider's eye mm-hmm. In alliance with other outsider perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Urvashi Vaad mentioned when she was here promoting her book that she doesn't really want us to become like heterosexuals. That is not what this movement is about. We are different. They have to come to us. Do you feel like aging has been a different experience for you because you're in the lesbian community as opposed to if you had stayed in the heterosexual community?
I have no idea.
You have no idea?
I have absolutely no idea.
Are you going to be writing
about
aging?
No, I don't know whether I will or not. I mean, you know, I'm really very opposed to categorizing some experience one's had and then deciding I must write about that. Mm-hmm. I'd rather let whatever I am and whatever I do and whatever I'm becoming sort of ooze into my work rather than single it out and say, oh, goody, now I'm 66, I'm going to write a book on aging.
Yeah.
I am interested in reading Studs Terkel's book of interviews with old people who have led very disparate kinds of lives, very diverse kinds of lives, men and women, people of very different class and ethnic backgrounds. I think that'll be fascinating, but all of his oral history is fascinating.
Yeah. His book, Working, touched me. When I was quite young, I read that one.
Me too.
You know, I wanted to ask you about Edgelet. It seems you're writing a kind of epitaph or confronting death. Is that your own death that you're talking about? You say, remember me, oh, remember me.
I was thinking of how many people have died in my communities, women of breast cancer, men from AIDS, how many people have died long before they've reached whatever is known as the coming of age. Mm-hmm. And that we're living in a society where people, which is supposed to be the most medically advanced in history and in the world, and in which for a variety of reasons, many of them political,
yes.
So many people are dying of drugs, of poverty. I would love to be able to convince anybody reading a poem that the eye in the poem does not necessarily and only reflect the eye of the writer, because an eye can be very complex, as can be a you and a we.
When I read the poem, I was thinking about some of my friends who have died, my mother dying of cancer and so on. But one wonders when people start writing about death, what it means.
Well, I've been writing about death since I was about 16 years old.
It seems to be the obsession of poets indeed.
Well, in one way or another, I think it's, you know, it is part of life.
I heard Joyce Carol Oates when she was in town recently, and she said there are some pieces, because they are so private and so frightening to her, that she cannot read them publicly. Do you have anything like that in your body of work?
Not consciously. I mean, I don't consciously avoid reading any poem that I've written and put out there.
Mm-hmm.
But then I tend to feel that once it's gone through the process of writing, which means many revisions, many puttings aside and then picking it up again, many transmutations of the original material, that by the time I publish a poem, it has become something that is no longer personal. I realize that we live in an age when people read everything as personal.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, deny the role of the imagination in the writer's work, which I think is a great pity. For me, the poem, once it's out in the world, It's not raw material from my life. It's not my intimate journals. It's not my intimate letters. I think it's really important, and it's increasingly difficult in the time we live in, culturally, to have a sense. I wouldn't say draw a line exactly, because it's not as simple as a line, but to have a sense of what's private and what's what is art and what is just your life. An artist makes art out of his or her life and much else, hopefully. And then it is impersonal. It becomes whatever it becomes. But your life is still your own.
Audrey and Rich, thank you for being with us on Hibernia Beach.
Thank you.
You know, I hadn't listened to my interview with her for quite a few years. It's been 18 years since I did it. I was amazed at how modern it still seemed. She could have been talking now.
I believe so.
About, the loss of privacy. And also, I was struck by the fact that she said that a lot of people read poetry and think the I is the writer, and it's not always the writer.
Exactly.
She explains that. Talk to us more about that, too, because you're a poet as well. Is that something that you would tell people as well?
Oh, absolutely. We can never assume that I is the poet. Some folks, again, like my friend Barbara Crooker, will absolutely say, I is always me in my poems. Others, no, it's the voice in the poem. And it's similar to writing a personal essay, even if it's based on real-life incidents. Once you're past it, you're still that little bit of fictionalizing whenever you use the first person in a poem.
Yeah.
But it allows then, especially a performer of the poem, to embrace that experience even more closely, to become as close as possible to that I, to that first person in the poem.
Yeah, yeah. I'm struck by how Audrey and Rich, all through the years, was able to strike the note of the universal, no matter what. And it almost feels like it means the world has not really changed as much as we had hoped. Where do you think we are with feminism right now after all these years? And
well,
our foremothers.
I'm thinking back to the fall when the IC Feminists had a little bit of performance art happening on the campus where people on small blackboards had to write why they need feminism. And immediately I wrote down, I need feminism because I am 60 years old and the world still has not changed enough.
Oh, yeah.
And anyone who says, however, I don't know, coined the word post-feminism. All I can think of is a stale breakfast cereal whenever I hear it. What a dangerous term. Then to make it passé, it's no longer chic. It's just, chic to be a feminist. To dare to say the word is becoming full of such dark baggage now that people will not even explore what the true definitions can be of it.
Yeah, and I say to people, if you're not a feminist, you're going to die. We need it so badly. Look at all the stuff in the news, the way women are still being treated, the way women are not assertive, and it's just amazing to me how people can just throw that word away and say we already won.
Yeah, anyone who is an adult, a female adult who calls herself a girl, I think on some level is placating and playing up to the greater powers of the patriarchy.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And diminishing her role in the world, obviously.
Absolutely.
Obviously. I want to talk to you about the fact that you also teach women's studies and writing. What do you tell your students about Audrey and Rich? So many probably have never even heard of her.
I don't think she's taught much in high schools, unfortunately, except for what I would see as more enlightened teachers who are able to work with poetry at all these days, really, since it's being pushed out of the curriculum. And it's one of the strongest approaches of political art that we have,
mm-hmm.
because so many people are loving poetry now. So to get Adrienne's poetry into their imaginations, into their voices, with them performing her, is so very, very important.
Yeah.
I recently completed teaching our writing course, Women in Writing, a 300-level class at Ithaca College, and had them read two books by Adrienne Rich, and most of them, oh my goodness, I'm so glad I finally learned about this woman. One was so taken, but she started writing prose poems in the style of Adrienne.
Wow.
With a mix of biography and politics.
Yeah. Now, I want to have you read Marge Piercy's incredible poem that she wrote after Audrey and Rich died.
Yes, I'd be very happy to, of course. Can't do it with the power of Marge, but I'll do my best. Another obituary. We were filled with the strong wine of mutual struggle. One joined loud and sonorous voice. We carried each other along, revolting, chanting, cursing, crafting, making all new. First Muriel, then Audrey and Flo, now Adrian. I feel like a lone pine remnant of virgin forest when my peers have met the axe and I weep ashes. Yes, young voices are stirring now. The wind is rising, the sea boils again, yet I feel age sucking the marrow from my bones, the loneliness of memory. Their voices murmur in my inner ear, but never will I hear them speak new words, and no matter how I cherish what they gave us, I want more. I still want more.
That's great. God, that you could feel the emotion in that. Well, Catherine Houghton-Machen, we're almost out of time. Can you leave us with a few last words on your thoughts about how Audrian's legacy will continue on for us?
Well, I hope that this interview, reaching, you know, thousands of people, will make people go out, buy her books, read her poetry, read her prose, tell other people to do that, and read it out loud as often as you can.
Catherine Houghton-Machen, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book's called Audrey and Rich, A Tribute Anthology.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.